The following Veterans Radio program is dedicated to those GIs who endured the horrible Korean winter of 1950-51.
Live from the Veterans Radio studios in Ann Arbor, Michigan, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host for today's program, Gary Lilly.
And good morning and welcome to Veterans Radio on this 4th of July weekend. Independence Day is what this holiday is all about. It was on the 4th of July that we declared ourselves a free nation. And I want to thank you for being with us. We've got a program today. We've had this gentleman on twice before, Paul Petraitis. He's written a book, Escape from North Korea. I'm holding it up to the camera for all of you that are watching. I interviewed Paul twice, and I had only had a chance to go through, kind of speed reading of the book, the first few paragraphs of different chapters and one chapter in its entirety and then skimming through some other things. And after the second interview, I found myself, because my commercial real estate business had had a break in there that allowed me to read the book, that I can't recommend a book any more than this book, Escape from North Korea by Paul G. Petraitis. I've always said that novels are better than stories. Somebody's writing about their own story, because in a novel you get into the person's head. The author describes the emotions and what's going on. And this book is not a novel. This book is Paul Petraitis' story, but it reads like a novel in that you get the emotions, you get what's going on in the mind. And since a lot of the book had to do with being by himself, that was what he wrote about, and hence the title, Escape from North Korea. He spent 14 days on his own making it back. However, in combat, you're still on your own, even if you've got somebody right next to you. There's not a lot of interplay between guys in a foxhole that are fighting for their lives. We talked about the Battle of Anhui, and which was the first battle of that Paul was involved with, and how ill-equipped our troops were for a very well-organized, brutal North Korean army, well-armed, experienced. And in the second time I had Paul on, we spoke about a battle in which the Chinese came in and overrunning American troops. It was only after that interview that I had a chance to read that entire chapter. And I want to tell you something. This book can't be put down. The front 80% reads like a novel, and the back 20% is a historical recap of the Korean War, in which I learned a great deal. And this morning I want to welcome an amazing person to Veterans Radio, Paul Petraitis. Paul, good morning, and thanks for being here.
Good morning, Mr. Lilly. Nice to talk to you again.
It's a pleasure. We've had some really great conversations off the air, like last evening, I believe, or was it the evening before last? And I've told you before what an amazing book you've written, and probably the best account of a person's experience in a war that I've ever read. And you had so much so many battles that each one of those battles would have made a story unto its own, but there was battle after battle after battle. How do you think you survived when so many around you did not? Have you ever thought about that?
Well, you mentioned Anhui, and that was the first baptism of it. And I was fortunate to be one of 21 out of 235 that got out of that ambush. I don't know what it was, but I was a very fortunate individual.
Of course, we're not going to talk about it on today's program. It's not what it's all about. But that question is asked by people who have been in war all the time. And it's one of the symptoms of PTSD, survivor guilt. Why did I survive when good people on either side of me didn't? I want to talk about that very last battle that you were in. The one in which the Chinese came over. I was thinking about it this morning at breakfast. How do I cover this book? And I thought, you can't cover the entire book. I can only pick out two different events and cover them well, hopefully well. And that last battle we talked about, but, you know, it didn't... I didn't visualize what was going on in that. You were way up near the Yalu River, and MacArthur had been warned, and our Secretary of State had been warned, and our Ambassador to China had been warned, do not approach the Yalu River because we will feel threatened, and we will not allow it to happen. That came from the Chinese. But yet MacArthur drove his army north after, you say, the war was won, which drove the North Koreans back to over the 38th parallel, and they were pretty much destroyed, their army. Had the Americans and the British pulled back and allowed the South Korean army to go on and mop up, it may have been something different, but that the Chinese may not have come in. But at the same time, you also wrote that the Chinese may have come in anyway because they would have known that South Korea was a great ally of the United States or vice versa, and they would have felt threatened with the Korea being united. So the fact of it, the matter is, though, despite warnings, you guys were up very, very close to the Yalu River, and some units that actually reached the Yalu River and were looking across the river at China. So that first night, the King Company of the 35th Regiment, I believe, you guys were barely dug in on top of a hill. Temperatures were in the 40 below range, so you couldn't do a lot of digging. You were in a very shallow foxhole when the Chinese showed up at night and came at you guys. Tell us a little bit about it, because you paint a vivid picture. You were in your foxhole when you saw them coming. The North Koreans always came with a bang with their cymbals and bugles and whistles and such, but the Chinese came in silently. How did you first spot them, and what was your thoughts?
The uniqueness of the Chinese were much different than the North Koreans, as you mentioned, and their style of fighting was just to overwhelm one. In my book, I indicated how every night we would come across enemy foxholes freshly dug and campfires that were burning out. And what they were doing, essentially, Mr. Lilly, was pulling back in a unified manner. And everyone there interpreted that as they were retreating. What they were doing was actually solidifying their line, so when whoever blew the starting gun, they attacked at least 300,000 all at once, and they literally destroyed the Allied army that night of November 27th. What they would do is they would breach the lines, and they would have divisions. Their divisions comprised 10,000 soldiers who would be there when the lines were breached by the first assault team of the Chinese, and these divisions would then run through the lines, not engage us at all, but just keep running for 5-10 miles, where they would set up roadblocks through these small roads that wound through these high cliffs, and then they would entrench there and prevent anybody from coming up to aid the South Koreans and mostly Americans.
And that night when they first hit, what you were describing was coming on their foxholes. They were drawing the American Army, the ROC Army, other allies deep into a trap. They weren't retreating. They were drawing the armies into a trap, and that was Mao Zedong's philosophy of war. You start off one of the chapters, the Chinese card. In order to draw an enemy into a fight unfavorable to him but favorable to us, we should often engage him when he is on the move and should look for conditions favorable to ourselves in the advantageousness of the terrain and fatigue and advertence on the part of the enemy. This means that we should allow the enemy to penetrate deep. That was Mao Zedong's philosophy, and that's exactly what was happening, correct, Paul?
That's right. That's exactly how he handled it, and MacArthur couldn't see it. Everyone was in awe and fear of MacArthur because of his reputation over the years, and he ended up calling it that phase an entirely new war, because he had assured President Truman that the Chinese would not come into the conflict, and if they did, it would be, quote, the biggest slaughter of all time, unquote.
Well, it
and it
into
was,
a big
but it wasn't the Chinese.
Right. It was a big slaughter, both sides, but as you mentioned in your book, or you say in your book, the Allies lost 60,000 troops in the first 2 weeks.
Yes. That's a little known statistic, if you will, about the war, but there are a number of books, military books, history, that address just these 2 weeks of combat, because it was really a different war, and it was a war that demolished both sides.
So the night that they came in, the night they started their offensive, King Company was dug in more or less on top of a hill. And you say that the ground was so hard that a lot of American companies along the lines didn't even dig in because they couldn't do it. Your company did. Pick up what happened when you first looked down the hill and you saw the Chinese. How did it look? What was it looking like to you?
We were fortunate that night that there was a harvest moon out, and it was almost like flares being tied to the sky. And it was so bright out because of the moon and the clear sky, it was so cold that it couldn't snow. And so we were just on top of this hill, and they were at the bottom trying to come up. And every time they forced themselves into a line to attack, boy, we would have retaliatory fire.
I lost my
phone.
Go ahead.
I think we killed, we found over close to 400 bodies the next morning.
Now, they had also dragged away a lot of their dead and wounded, wasn't it?
They do. They do, yeah.
How close did they get? They were coming up the hill, and at times they had to climb over the bodies of their own comrades. How close did they get to your fighting hole?
Actually, we had quite an advantage because there was almost a cliff in front of us, so they couldn't get up to us at that point. I would judge they would be 20 to 30 yards away, as opposed to earlier in the war where, God, they would be right on top of you before you could stop them.
Define right on top of you. How close would that be? And we're talking about the North Korean army earlier in the war.
Oh, 5 feet perhaps. They would die right in front of the foxholes.
You were an 18-year-old kid, and you were surrounded by other teenagers. And this experience, people don't realize, and I didn't realize until I read your book, just how experienced the North Korean army was, how tough it was, and how well-equipped it was. So as an 18-year-old that had received almost no training after basic training, you guys were fighting this brutal, and they were brutal. They were sadistically brutal. Let there be no mistake about that. What prepared you for it?
I'm sorry?
What prepared you for having enemy soldiers charging to within 5 feet of you?
You know, the fear factor is always deducted, but in reality, one is so busy concentrating and trying to save themselves that fear doesn't seem to enter into it at the time. It's after the lull of the battle that you start contemplating, you know, what could have happened. And it affects a person for life.
Certainly. Back on the hill when the Chinese attacked, your company was strung out so wide that you couldn't see each other's foxholes. You could only see the muzzle flash of other weapons to know that there were foxholes to the left and right of you. Is that right?
That's correct.
How close did the Chinese get to those other fighting holes?
Some of them that were on a navigable slope were killed right in their foxholes by the Chinese that could get to them. It was so overwhelmingly populated, the enemy, that one couldn't fire fast enough to stop them.
King Company held, and other units around you didn't fare so well, but King Company seemed to be the point that they had picked out to break a hole in the line, and there were then thousands and thousands of Chinese in reserve that were going to pour through that line and get to the rear of the regiment and attack and cut it off. But you guys held against... How many do you believe were attacking you?
I would judge in the thousands easily. And it wasn't just our position, it was all along the line that was so haphazard because of people just trying to get to the border on the orders of General MacArthur that they threw caution to the wind. Guys would be so exhausted that they couldn't take another step, and yet they would force us to keep going up to the border. The Chinese had something to say about that, didn't they?
I guess they did. They actually did get behind you, and they got into your mortar platoon. Is that
they
right?
Did. They captured and killed all of the mortars, and then they turned them on us. And in retrospect, one finds that they forced American soldiers to use their captured mortars against us, so they had maximum ability, if you will, to destroy us.
So they actually had the soldiers that they captured used the mortars against you guys because they were better trained to do it. Is that correct?
Exactly.
I had never heard that before. Okay. I wanted to save the next segment for your escape. After the battle was over, and General Walker, the commanding general of your army, your division, I guess, realized that it was a big mistake, and so he slowed down and kept you guys from going all the way up to the river because he felt bad things were coming. Is that correct?
Yes, but we didn't know that at the time, and so consequently, we kept going until when the Chinese struck. It was such chaos that I read word all these units were totally overrun by the Chinese, and they were all pleading for help, but there was no help because the Chinese were so overwhelmingly there. Interesting enough for my viewpoint is, since I've read so much in conjunction with writing my book, I understand the Chinese point. We did that in Cuba, didn't we, when that crisis in 62 came up, because every country has a right to protect their borders.
And we feel that way. I'll drop that subject. So you started to withdraw after that battle.
We did. We lost, I would judge, and we didn't know it at the time, but about a third of the company of mortally wounded and dead GIs, we pulled back. We just literally ran for half a day, and in doing so, we were lost our positions, and our company commander was severely wounded that night, and I to this day I don't know how they got him out, because as soon as the Chinese run through our lines, they would set up these skirmish lines to stop anyone to come for our help.
And it was easy for them to isolate because there were very few roads. Americans cannot picture it, I am absolutely certain. And the mountain chain ran north and south, dividing the Korean Peninsula into two, basically two sections. And there was no fighting that could be done or advancing for either side in the heavy, heavy mountainous rain. So everybody was using the sides, skirting the edge of the mountains. Is that right?
That's right. It was called the Gap, and it became a big issue after the war when they investigated it and dissected it. And what it did, it prevented the Allied line from being a unified line, defensive line for us. They were, in fact, two different lines, two different battles, two different armies. Everything was different about it. And it was the first time in modern warfare where MacArthur just led two different armies, actually.
So there was the east and the west side. Is that right? The east side and the west side of the Korean Peninsula?
That's right, yeah. Separated by this mountain chain you spoke of that they called the Gap because it was so formidable nobody could penetrate it. So there were two isolated armies.
You said that you ran pretty much half the day. There was no snow on the ground to speak of?
There was, But as long as we stayed on the road, we could handle it. It's when we veered off and went through these abandoned fields and then up into the mountains that it became so treacherous with snow that one couldn't navigate.
And the reason why you had to leave, what the Chinese strategy was, to blow through the lines, get behind you, and set up roadblocks on these very few two-lane gravel roads that ran north and south.
Exactly, yeah. Of all the units on line that night, they say the 2nd Division suffered by far the worst. Just through a stroke of the fate of cards, if you will, that they were just demolished by the Chinese armies.
And when you were on that road, you were forced off of it by one of those roadblocks, which were set up in consecutive roadblocks. If you broke through one, then there'd be another one down the road. So you ran into a roadblock, and the company commander led you off to the top of a hill.
That's right. And then the mortars started coming in. American mortars, now we find, were fired by American soldiers at us at the demand of the Chinese. Either use our mortars or we'll kill you.
The snow was deep. Did you spend the night up on that hill, or did you were you forced off of it right away?
We broke up in platoon-sized groups. As I mentioned earlier, our company commander had been seriously wounded that night, and so we had a new captain who had no combat experience, and he kind of fell apart. And so the platoon leaders, the lieutenants that ran 42-man platoons, kind of took over and organized withdrawals. So I was about in the third unit of 40 guys.
In fact, that we're on the, I won't ask you to respond to this because there's not enough time other than to agree. That company commander, as you said, fell apart, and he gave an order that was unheard of: every man for himself.
He sure did. He sure did. And that's when the lieutenant stepped forward, the platoon leaders.
As I said, we can't. We'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Captain George McMurtry, wounded on two separate occasions, continued to lead his battalion in combat in World War I. Details after this.
An Air Force F-16 fighter jet accelerates from zero to the speed of sound in about a minute. But if you're looking to soar, there's something that can take you higher than any aircraft: a good education. So stay in school, graduate, and see how high you can climb. The future is wide open with that diploma in your hand. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on at airforce.com. Cross into the blue with the U.S. Air Force. No one comes close.
McMurtry was commander of a battalion which was cut off and surrounded by the enemy. And although wounded in the knee by shrapnel and suffering great pain, he continued throughout the entire period to encourage his officers and men with an optimism that contributed largely toward preventing panic and disorder among the troops, who were without food and cut off from communications with our lines. During a heavy barrage, he personally directed and supervised the moving of the wounded to a shelter before himself seeking shelter. 2 days later, he was again wounded, this time in the shoulder by a German grenade, but continued to personally organize and direct the defense against the German attack on the position until the attack was defeated. He continued to direct and command his troops, refusing relief and personally led his men out of the position after assistance arrived before permitting himself to be taken to the hospital. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
We're back on Veterans Radio. We're talking to Paul Petraitis, whose book, Escape from North Korea, is one that I can highly recommend. It ought to be in school libraries, too. So, and when you look for the book, type in Paul Petraitis' name, because there are three or four books with the same title, Escape from North Korea. And it's Paul, middle initial G, as in, what was the military for G? I don't remember. George Petraitis, Petraitis. And I should mention that Veterans Radio is coming to you from our flagship station, WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, over the Ave Maria Radio Network, and over the Internet to all points of the world. Thank you again for listening in. Paul, the lieutenants took over their platoons. I don't know whatever happened. I guess the captain went along with one of the platoons because, according to your book, he survived. You got into a platoon that was one that you weren't familiar with. Is that right?
That's right. Soldiers are so isolated from each other that a company that's generally consist of a little over 200 men, often times more than not, don't know each other because they're separated by distance so much. And consequently, even though it's one unified unit, the soldiers didn't know each other, and that's what I encountered. I knew a few, but they essentially broke up into 40 platoon strength, 40 soldiers, a group, and they would head out trying to penetrate the ring that the Chinese put against us, and actually only one platoon got out, and the reason they got out for some crazy reason was they escaped towards the enemy, and we thought we were safer because the enemy wasn't around us. Well, we didn't realize at the time that they were there. And consequently, the three groups that went west to try to get back to American lines were all captured. And depending on what group you were in, was how you made it. In my particular group, after we surrendered, they started shooting us all down. In other groups, they just took them as hostages and treated them fairly well. Another group, they lined 40 soldiers up, and a Chinese major went behind them and shot every fourth guy in the back of the head. So it was a kind of a luck of the dice, so to speak.
It's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine if you're putting yourself emotionally or you know, mentally into the shoes of you guys. It's just hard to imagine. And we talked the last segment about how you did escape. Two of you escaped because you didn't trust them. You held back. And when they started, so you were on the end of the line on this narrow path. So when they started killing all the POWs, you grabbed the guy next to you, you ran, hid in the bushes, and subsequently got away. Now, the part that we have not covered is basically about the title of the book, Escape from North Korea. You guys had to hide until dark, did you, before you felt it was safe enough to start walking?
We did, and we were lying in this ditch trying to cover ourselves with foliage so we wouldn't be seen. And we were very fortunate. The Chinese never came back to look. And so we laid there until dark, and it was so cold. I just remember trying to get up, and here I was in relatively good shape as an 18-year-old, and yet I felt like a broken-down old man because of the attack of the cold, the incredible cold there. It's indescribable.
It was the
but
coldest history.
I should say this. Had it not been for a chance meeting with, I found some refugees, North Korean people that smuggled me out.
Paul, let's hold up there, because there was a lot that happened. There was about a week's worth of time before you ran into those. And I would like to walk the listening audience through your story. That winter was the coldest winter in Korean history, 40 to 50 below zero. Am I right?
That's right. And we didn't have any cold weather equipment. It was all stacked up down in Pyongyang, where the North Korean capital was, where they were directing the war. And they ended up burning all of that equipment and food and ammunition and when the Chinese overran. And it was the biggest retreat in the history of our country, 250 miles. And that's why there's a North and a South Korea today, because of some very poor strategy.
And it ended up reverting back to the original lines.
Jerry?
In the end, it reverted back to the original line of division between North and South Korea, the 38th parallel.
That's exactly right.
All of that. When you started walking that first night, what were your plans?
Well, we were so disoriented, we had no idea which way we were going. And again, that moon was so bright, you could just see almost forever, like it was daylight. But we had no concept if we were going north or south or what. So we just kept walking.
But were you walking on the roads?
Well, where we were, they were not roads per se. They were more like trails, and so had we found some roads, we could have probably figured out, you know, at least eliminated it to north and south. But where we were, as I mentioned, were just trails, and we had no idea which way to go.
By luck?
And then we ended up in the mountains for some reason. It was just like some siren luring us back into the mountains all the time.
By luck, did you happen to go generally south?
I'm sorry?
I said, by sheer luck, did you happen to go generally south?
To this day, I'll never know. We could have walked in a huge circle. It was only until we found some main roads that we could figure out north and south. And that was at least a day later. And in fact, that night we were walking down this road, and We had no idea, but the Chinese were so far ahead of us that I guess they just waited for us, and when we got close enough, they opened fire and they killed my friend who escaped with me, and I was blessed by getting away again.
You, when they opened up, you started running across the field, and that was when he was shot and killed?
I'm sorry?
I said when they opened up on you, you had to break and run across an open field, and that's when your friend was shot, and you made
it.
Yes. Where did you go for cover?
Well, I didn't realize it at the time. I thought they would be chasing us, so I kept running. But now, in retrospect, I realize they didn't care. There were, you know, there were hundreds and thousands of them, and most of the Americans had retreated, the Allies. And so, you know, they would shoot at you, but then they wouldn't pursue you. And I didn't realize till I finally got back to safety that that's what it was.
When we get into the last segment, and I want to talk then about your chance meeting with the refugees that eventually led to your escape. But during all this time, when was the last time you had food?
I'm sorry?
When was the last time that you ate?
Oh, it was the day before the original attack, so it would have been November 26th, and I didn't get back till December 12th, and I didn't have anything to eat for all those days, 16 days, as I recall. Surprisingly, and we went without food a lot. We were always short of food and ammunition, and I discovered after the third day of fasting, forced fasting, that one could handle it after that for some reason.
Paul, we're coming up on a break. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
We're back on Veterans Radio talking to Paul Petratus, whose book, Escape from North Korea, is just a masterpiece, in my opinion. We've got one segment left, and it's the whole title of the book, Your Escape. The first half of the escape, you were on your own, and you had a lot of near misses in the meantime, and then you entered a village in which there were a lot of refugees. At that point, you didn't feel like you could stick to the mountains anymore. What happened when you entered that village?
To start with, it was quite unique that it was occupied because there were just literally hundreds of thousands of North Korean civilians that were heading south to get into South Korea. And so this was quite unique to come across this village just teeming with people. It must have been some kind of a staging area where they, through their grapevine, may have, established this village as a place to meet and then continue south. At any rate, I was outside of the village watching all the people trying to determine if it was safe to walk through this village, even though it was occupied, because there was no way I could walk around the village. It was just too far of a distance. And while I was waiting and watching everyone, a North Korean young man in a high school uniform came up upon me, and when he saw me, he literally panicked and screamed and ran into the village itself. So I thought, well, I don't have a lot of options now, so I just walked in, and through this chance meeting, I met Mr. Kim, a very common name in the Korean dialect there, that was also a prisoner, a political prisoner of the North Koreans. They had them by the hundreds of thousands, and they were killing all of their own people as they were retreating north. But then the Allied pressure was so high on the North Koreans before the Chinese came in that they just started abandoning them. These guys broke out of prison, and through this incredible fortune, I met them there, one of which, Mr. Kim, who spoke excellent English, and it was almost a godsend, without a doubt.
We have to condense this so much. It's so remarkable. There is so much in between before and after and such, but during you joined the refugees, and there was a grapevine, as you said, that news spread fast, and you had come to an abandoned village, and there was all sorts of commotion. What went on there?
I never did find out why the village was so occupied, but Mr. Kim told me that he believed that they couldn't get into South Korea, that we sealed the border off. And I knew otherwise, but I didn't say anything. And so we entered this agreement that I would speak for those people if they would get me back. And
that's kind of remarkable.
They knew if they stayed there and the Chinese came back, or the North Koreans, they would kill them themselves. So it was a quid pro quo, so to say.
Right. And it's kind of amazing, because here you were, an American soldier in a North Korean village surrounded by North Korean refugees, but they didn't treat you in an unfriendly manner.
That's amazing. And I found that to be true even before I went in this village, when I would try to figure, I would find homes that were still occupied, very rarely, but when I found them, the people were relatively friendly and would point me in the right direction.
Okay, you left that village and you were amongst the refugees. They had a grapevine that went pretty fast. You came to another village. There was a lot of commotion, and Mr. Kim almost pushed you into another man, half carried you into a home because your feet were so frozen at that point and turning to gangrene. They got you in there, and that describe what happened once you got inside that empty house, hut, whatever.
They had a logistic system that I never quite understood, but homes at that time of the year, you might as well be outside. If you were inside and it wasn't heated, it was as cold inside the houses as outside. And for some reason, every night when we stopped, and when I say we, there were about eight of us, I guess, all North Koreans except me. We would find these heated homes. I noticed Mr. Kim would be looking around to determine which one it was. And I don't, to this day, I'm dumbfounded by whomever would have heated these homes. But it saved my life.
The Chinese happened to come on that day that they dragged you into that home. The Chinese army showed up.
Yes. You have to imagine these roads. In my book, I put in a photograph of the refugee lines, but they were literally packed. Person to person. If a person fell in that road, he would die because this incredible mass of humanity would just literally pulverize you into the dirt. And yet the Chinese were there after all those days, and I was astounded that they could do that because they obviously didn't use the road because the road was so packed with humanity. And in my studies later, I found...
Paul, are you there? What happened was Paul Petraitis had been dragged into a hut in a village that was abandoned. And there was a mat in there that Mr. Kim and the other person threw over the top of him, and he didn't know what to do. The Chinese soldiers kept on almost a run, running past that hut, and he could see them and was terrified that one of them would open the door and look inside, because if they did, there was absolutely no way that he could have remained hidden under a mat. They would have seen something, a bulge there, and that was the only item that was in the room. And so the Chinese didn't look in. He was fortunate, and after they had left, Mr. Kim and the other person came back and got him out of there. And Paul's back on the line. Paul, I just described what happened in that on that hut when the Chinese army came by and you escaped. We have 1 minute left for you. What was the final? What happened when you met up with the friendly army?
Well, of course, for me, I didn't know at the time what was going on. I was thrown into this house and I was by myself, and
I already described that while you were off the air. We've got 50 seconds left. You met up with the South Korean army.
I did. I first found a doctor. They found me, actually, that looked at my feet. And then South Korean soldiers, they were also behind the lines, but they had vehicles, and they took me in the jeep and put me in the commanding general's jeep, and we finally made it out after 14 days.
And at that point, you broke down and started crying. Paul Petraitis, the book, Escape from North Korea, get it and read it and then pass it on. Next week, we've got an amazing story. And until then, you are dismissed.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.